Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. As UN aid convoys prepared to deliver more relief to quake-hit northwest Syria on Tuesday, UN humanitarians warned that thousands of children have likely been killed, while millions more vulnerable people urgently need support. From the UN Children's Fund UNICEF, spokesperson James Elder warned that cases of hypothermia and respiratory infections are on the rise among youngsters, as he appealed for continued solidarity with all those affected by the emergency.
Everyone everywhere needs more support, more safe water, more warmth, more shelter, more fuel, more electricity, more medicines, more funding. Families with children up there sleeping in the streets, malls, schools, mosques, under bridges, staying out in the open because of fear of returning to their homes.
To Tunisia, where the country's deepening crackdown against political opponents and civil society has been condemned by UN Rights Chief Volker Türk. Since Saturday, at least 9 people have been reportedly arrested and some detained on security and corruption charges, the High Commissioner for Human Rights said in a statement. Criminal charges have included conspiracy against state security, said Mr. Türk, who expressed concern that military courts had been used to try some of those being held. Those arrested include former civil servants and a former finance minister, opposition party members, 2 judges, a former human rights minister, a law professor and a blogger, according to the High Commissioner's office. Infectious disease control experts from the UN Health Agency, WHO, have been deployed to Equatorial Guinea to help contain the country's first outbreak of Marburg virus. 9 people have reportedly died from the virus in western Kinatem province. Marburg is from the same family as the Ebola virus. Its symptoms include fever, fatigue and blood-stained vomit and diarrhea. To support the national response, WHO has provided expertise in epidemiology, case management, infection prevention and risk communication to build trust with affected communities. In Geneva on Tuesday, the WHO also convened an emergency meeting of its Marburg virus vaccine consortium. Although there are no vaccines or antiviral treatments for the virus, a number of vaccine candidates are in the early stages of testing. A range of other potential treatments also exists, including blood products, immune and drug therapies. And finally, a call from UN agriculture experts to improve the management of grasslands for the sake of our shared climate goals. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, soils are the second largest carbon store on the planet after oceans. This means that they already play an important role in climate change mitigation, but if grasslands were tended to better than they are currently, they could store much more carbon, keeping it from entering the atmosphere, FAO researchers have insisted. The other benefits of better grasslands management include new insights into food security and biodiversity conservation, FAO said in a call for further research. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day today. Coming up in the second hour, courtesy UC Radio, Maria Gilardin.
Chris Hedges interviews Matt Taibbi. Hamilton 68 was a Twitter-based dashboard designed to be used by reporters to measure Russian disinformation. The panic that followed the election of Donald Trump often relied on a source now known to have been fraudulent. Hamilton 68. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Definitely a good thing to check into, the counterfeit organization on the internet, Hamilton 68. Absolutely some of the latest news available, courtesy Maria Gilardin and Chris Hedges. And now, Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith.
Overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century.
That is Australian biologist Corey Bradshaw, professor of global ecology at Flinders University, Adelaide. Corey returns to Radio EcoShock with this update from the real world of living things.
They've said that there'll be a 7.22% fall in GDP by 2100 from a 3.2 degree increase in Celsius in temperature. What they're doing is really saying you can find the footprint for global warming in current data. And that's just nonsense, because it's a cascading effect, and it's the runaway process that we are now very, very close to triggering. That is the really scary thing. The complete structural breakdown of our climate will occur over the next 80 years. And all these predictions are just nonsense.
Then, why do top economists claim global warming over 3 degrees will cause only minor damage to the economy? From the Analysis.News podcast, Colin Anthes interviews Australian economist Steve Keen about crazy numbers from the people who advise governments, banks, and business. I'm Alex Smith. It's all Voices from Down Under this week on Radio EcoShock. Children born today will see literally thousands of animals disappear in their lifetime as global food webs collapse. That is a quote from new research by two established scientists. One is European Commission-affiliated scientist Dr. Giovanni Strona. The other is our guest, Professor Corey Bradshaw at Flinders University. From Adelaide, Australia, Corey Bradshaw, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Good to be back.
Yes, well, I think we should begin by introducing the idea of co-extinction. What is that, and why are we just kind of learning about it now?
Well, co-extinction, the concept has been around for quite some time. I mean, theoretically at least, going back probably over a century, it's kind of one of the fundamental aspects of ecology is that all species are, of course, connected in some form. No species lives in a vacuum. They all depend to some extent on other species, just like human beings depend on, you know, all the species we eat and the species that take care of our ecosystem services, like producing oxygen, for example, or purifying our water or sequestering our carbon. So we all depend on living things within the biosphere. So co-extinctions, they're really actually quite simple. If a particular species goes extinct and then all the species that depend on that species cannot shift their relationships, whether that be whether it's something they eat or another resource they gain off that species, they too will ultimately go extinct. So it's this idea of an extinction cascade, or co-extinction is the term we're using here. So it's only really been in the public eye really in the last few years, because we've realized that many of the forward projections about future extinctions don't really take into account this aspect of extinction cascades or co-extinctions.
And you and Giovanni also talk about edge species. What are they? I looked up edge species, and they are, you know, those that are at the strange ends of the evolution spectrum, you could say.
I don't think that's the definition we're using here. Let me just, we actually use edge in two ways. One is, it's actually, an edge is considered the interaction within a network, so the relationship between two species. The other aspect of edge is the limits of a species' particular tolerances to its environment. So in this case, we're using primarily precipitation and temperature. So it's the edge of their niche, if you will. So what they can withstand, their physiological capability. So that's how we're using it in this context. From like network terminology, that is beyond even ecology. I mean, we've stolen a lot of the network principles from computing, IT, and physics, which we've adapted to biological systems. But the terminology used to talk about the connection between two modes is an edge as well. It's a little bit confusing.
According to your comprehensive analysis, what is the best and worst case scenario in a nutshell for extinctions this century?
Well, overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century. So what that looks like is, in reality, we're not talking about extinction per se. Extinction is the loss of all individuals within a species. We're talking about biodiversity loss. So this is, for example, you look out your window today and you count the number of animal species that you see. and then you look out that same window in 2100 and you count the same number of animal species, on average, you're going to see about, well, the exact number we came up with is about 17.6%, so about 20%, or one in five species disappearing. So that's about double what we had anticipated previously from climate change by just looking at the thermal tolerances, that is how much temperature extremes particular species can withstand before they go extinct.
So it's the interrelationship of animals that create a kind of a feedback effect that make extinction higher than we thought.
Yeah, well, you can think about it like this. Let's say, the obvious one is predators and their prey species. So if a particular predator specializes on eating a particular prey species, and it's not a generalist, as we say, it can't just eat whatever's going. It tends to specialize on particular species, and most predators are, in fact, quite specialized. Then if the prey species go extinct, then the predator has nothing to eat because it doesn't have the time to evolve a response to a different sort of diet. So it goes extinct. And really the timing is key here because over evolutionary timescales, of course, things wax and wane, and if there are slow changes, evolution can kind of take over and adapt the species to the new situation. But the climate change is happening so quickly that most species don't have much time to adapt. There is some adaptation, but it's very small. And we've actually coded in that adaptation into the model. Now, you can think of other relationships like pollination is a great example. So many flowering plants have very specialist animal pollinators, mostly insects. Some birds, some bats, that sort of thing. But if those specialist pollinators, and many pollinators only pollinate a few, if not one species of plant, if those pollinators go extinct, then the plant can't reproduce, and ultimately it'll die out and it can't, make any new individuals for the next generations. Or something else that probably goes by the wayside for many people is parasites and their hosts. Parasites usually tend to be very host-specific, and if the host dies, then all the parasites that depend on that host will also go extinct. Now, a lot of people think that that's not necessarily a bad thing. Who wants parasites? But parasites are kind of fundamental aspects of many ecosystems, and without them, we wouldn't have the same diversity that we have today. And it turns out that probably many of the big extinction events that have happened in the past, a large part of that has been the loss of parasites, which has really taken biodiversity and knocked it on the head.
So as I see it, you created a model to test responses by a representative cast of vertebrates to different levels of climate change. And it almost sounds like a game with virtual animals, but a lot of math in the engine. Is that a reasonable description? And can you cross-check this study with what happens in the real world?
Yeah, so obviously a model is an abstraction. One of my favorite quotes is from the late George Brooks, who's about a statistician. He said that all models are wrong, but some are useful. So all models are by definition an abstraction or a simplification of a complex universe. But what they try to do, if they're useful, is to garner the main tendencies within a system. And models really only become useful when they're used in a comparative sense. So we contrast one future scenario with another, and we look at the relative change. It's not saying that this or this will happen. It's just like this is much worse than this situation, for example. So yes, it is an abstraction. Each of the individual species therein are actually not linked exactly to every species on the planet. We are making virtual Earths, but we're not doing an exact replica of Earth. We still don't have the data or the computing complexity to be able to do a completely virtual Earth, but we can get the main dynamics pretty well. And one of the ways we validate that is to look at the inherent distribution of diversity on the planet in a spatial sense derived from the primary inputs of the model. And it turns out, based on real data, that we can actually put the actual pattern of biodiversity, relative biodiversity, that is the number of species per unit area, across the entire globe really, really well. So we kind of know that this system is operating in a realistic sense. We're also using real data to look at this, for example, the distribution of species in different groups of animals, also in how they adapt to their environment, so this adaptation aspect, their dispersal rates, the proportion of species in different levels of a food web, for everything from the top predators right down to the herbivores. Now, where we don't have great information is the dynamics within the plants and the invertebrates. That's mainly due to the fact we don't have great data on those kind of linkages between those different groups and then their linkages to the vertebrates above them. So our model actually assumes that the primary resources, that is the plants and the insects, are inexhaustible, which is not the case, actually. So you can take our predictions as actually quite conservative, because if catastrophes happen really at the bottom of the food web, in the plants in particular, we vastly underestimated the extinction rates, and that's even scarier.
So we hear a mass extinction event could be developing right now, and then we go back to our lives and social media feeds. Humans just don't grasp this situation well. Could you paint us any photos of what living through a die-off would be like?
Well, the way I describe it to many people is that the future is not going to be very nice. It's actually, the term we use is ghastly. Now, that's an evocative and emotive term, but it basically means that our lifestyles and our standards of living will plummet, and they already are starting to plummet for many people in the world, especially the people with the fewest resources. The poor are getting nailed the hardest by climate change, for example, climate refugees, warfare, loss of food production, that sort of thing. Lots of suffering, ultimately lots of death, and really a poorer standard of living for all people. Now, the wealthiest will be buffered from that for some time, and that's probably why we don't hear a lot about it, is because that buffering is happening as we speak, but those are the people that kind of control the media. We, the wealthy people of the world, even though we're a minority, control most of the information flow. So until it affects us directly, and, it is starting to do that both in terms of, say, for example, floods and bushfires, extreme heat waves. It's starting to sort of trickle through, but the severity of the implications down the track haven't even begun to hit home with the people that control the information flow. Now, we try as we might with, scientific endeavor to educate people about the severity of this. It's in a lot of ways, I remain pessimistic that most people won't do much until the crunch actually happens.
You list five dominant drivers in this sixth mass extinction: land use change, overharvesting, pollution, climate change, and biological invasions. I'll bet most people put land use change first, like burning down the Amazon, as the number one cause of extinctions. What did you find?
Well, there's no question that in the past, especially in the last few hundred years, and the massive expansion, especially of European colonization around the planet, the main driver has certainly been habitat loss, cutting down forests, turning plains into agricultural areas. Those have been the primary drivers of species loss up until quite recently. But climate change will take over that loss. We've included in these particular models projected trends in continued habitat loss right to the end of the century. And it turns out that that's actually quite a minor component of the overall extinction rate once you take extinction cascades or co-extinctions into account. Now, that is surprising some people, and to be honest, during the review process, it even surprised our reviewers. But when you think about it objectively, much of that legacy effect, so the previous extinctions and the extinctions that will happen because of past deforestation due to something we call extinction lag. So often you'll get, for example, an area that's deforested, a lot of those species will die immediately, but a lot just sort of move into smaller patches. Ultimately, they're doomed, but it takes many generations of those species. And if you can think of a long-living tree, for example, generations can be measured on a century scale. It takes some time for those extinctions to be realized. So we're still living the legacy of past habitat loss-related extinctions, but if they haven't already, they will very soon be taken over by climate change because of these extinction cascades.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the Matthew Flinders Professor of Global Ecology, Corey Bradshaw. We are talking about wildlife disappearing as this century unfolds. Corey, you've published and spoken on the dangers and costs of invasive species, and Australia, biologically isolated as it was for so long, is particularly at risk, and there's been some bad examples, the rabbits, the cane toads, we could go on. So with global business and travel, humans are mixing in large cities, but is globalization a good idea for the other species?
Well, it's not a good idea for other species nor ourselves. I mean, we've done some work recently showing that we're, you know, invasive species cost the planet somewhere in the vicinity of several $100 billion a year, and that's increasing. So just in terms of gross economics, you know, damage to crops, the cost of managing invasive species, the precipitation through the loss of other species, native species that are useful to us, have direct economic detriment. And I'm really, when I'm saying hundreds of billions, I'm not exaggerating. So the other aspect that invasive species do is, of course, they weaken native ecosystems and the connections between species because they tend to simplify those systems. So they can replace some of the functions of lost native species, but generally speaking, they take over components of those ecosystems and dominate them, which makes them overall less resilient to disturbances. So invasive species actually make everything else worse. Now, we weren't modeling invasive species, so you can look at our work as taking some of the two main drivers of extinction, putting them together, so that's climate change and habitat loss. But happening over top of all of that are things like pollution and invasive species and over-exploitation that contribute even more to extinction. So as I said earlier, our models are actually extremely conservative from that respect.
Is the issue of invasive species separate from climate change?
Yes and no. There's no direct necessity for an invasive species, its dynamics to be related to climate change, but many species do respond to it positively. For example, the movement of tropical species into temperate zones, let's say insect vectors of diseases, malaria, dengue, that sort of thing, they can expand their ranges, and many invertebrates are in fact expanding their ranges because of this warming effect. So we're tropicalizing many parts of the temperate world. And the tropics harness more species, but they tend to be dominated by those that are the most generalist and that have the most damage. So climate change can facilitate invasion of alien species, but it's not a necessary part of the invasion process. Most invasions actually happen from direct or indirect introduction by humans through commerce.
Your virtual world also finds species get smaller as the world gets hotter, and I have heard that from other science. Does that mean, though, that we lose the large iconic animals like elephants or bears first?
Yes. Those species tend to have very large ranges to garner the resources necessary to maintain those large bodies. So there's a really good relationship between the size of an animal and the area over which it roams, and that's really just so that it can gain the essential resources it needs to complete its life cycle. So if resources are limiting in any sense, they become the first to drop off the perch because they can't complete their life cycles. Now, if you're smaller, there's one advantage of having a smaller area in which you are required to garner those resources, and you can withstand certain perturbations that might affect larger species more intensively. But the downside of that, of course, is that if you're restricted in range, one small disturbance event, for example, like a bushfire or a cyclone, can wipe out your entire population or the only population left in the entire species, which means that you're susceptible to these random events that wouldn't necessarily knock out a species that's spread over a much larger range. So it's kind of a balancing act. This is why we have both large and small species that have evolved, because there's a certain advantage under certain environmental conditions, either to being big or being small or anything in between. This is the diversity we have on the planet. But when things change extremely rapidly, as they are today, and due to entirely to human endeavor, the bigger things tend to drop off the perch first, yes.
Why do you and Giovanni Strona say, quote, the bleakest time for natural communities might be imminent?
We said that because some of the processes that we modeled, their starting points were actually within the next few decades, if not even this decade. So the processes that ultimately lead to co-extinction are starting now. So the more we can limit the changing temperature profiles now, the less likely co-extinctions will occur in the future. So one of the interesting components of the model is actually the middle-range climate projection scenario based on an emissions profile that's sort of mid-range from what we expect over the next few decades at least, is the scenario actually had some of the highest co-extinctions because the very high-intensity warming scenario, more species went extinct from primary extinctions. That means exceeding their thermal tolerance. In other words, we had already lost those species, so there were fewer species to lose from these cascading effects. So really, it's about stopping the cascade early on in the series, because otherwise we're going to not be able to get a handle on this sort of runaway extinction cascade thereafter.
Many of our listeners worry about collapse and resiliency. In your new paper on the extinction crisis, you remind us of a 2016 paper by Strona. It suggests life systems that look strongest may actually be the most fragile. And that sort of reminds me of the collapse of the Soviet Union or the Lehman Brothers, which we never thought was possible. But in Living Affairs, what does Strona's work say about surprises in the survival of animals?
I think a lot of Giovanni's work and our own together suggests that it's really difficult to predict what a collapse might look like or how many connections must be lost in a complex system before things collapse. Even collapse is kind of a loaded term because it depends how you define that. Is collapse simply a loss of overall function? Is it a loss of diversity? Or is it wiping out the entire community? There's various interpretations of what that means. But I'll come back to the current paper. We did find that the number of connections within these systems actually dropped more than the number of species being lost. In other words, you think about it like a latticework or scaffolding. You know, you can knock out bars here and there, and the scaffolding still stands up. And up to a point, it looks strong and it looks intact. But you knock out, that last bar, and the whole thing will start to crumble. We don't really have a good handle on when that happens, but we do know that when you knock out bars from the scaffolding, you weaken the entire structure. That's why we have, the entire thing intact to begin with, so that it withstands those kind of shocks, like, wind coming along or some, earthquakes or whatever that might knock that scaffolding down. The fewer bars that link up the pieces that exist within that scaffolding, the more likely it is to collapse under another kind of disturbance.
And now we have big foundations to save iconic wildlife. People do care about animals, and some of these foundations work to create protective islands of nature for tigers or butterflies. But Corey, do they know about climate and co-extinctions?
Generally speaking, our conservation approaches are very much behind the ecological understanding. There are pushes within conservation biology and the conservation science in general to incorporate some of these. So there are processes and plans to do things called assisted migration, for example. So that's taking species that perhaps might be adapted to a particular area today, but in 50 years they won't be. So considering about moving species to anticipate the changing climate. There's also the idea of genetic rescue, and taken to the ultimate extreme would be genetic modification through things like CRISPR technology, where you can actually provide a genetic resilience to species by shifting species around and adding different genomes into populations. So there are aspects of this, but generally speaking, it's hard enough just to get an area put aside for species to conserve them, let alone anticipate all the future challenges that they'll face. That's extremely true on land. It's probably more flexible in the oceans, but even then, I think just the ability to make long-term plans is compromised by the fact that the wheels turn very slowly in commerce and economics.
You present startling numbers about the way things should go. Do you have any cautions about this paper and what studies are still needed to make us even more confident about this dark picture of extinction?
Yeah, a couple of things I've sort of alluded to over the course of the interview. One is getting a better handle on what's happening with the plants and the insects. A lot of people are alluding to the loss of insects around the world. You hear everything from insectageddon to catastrophic loss of all sort of main pollination services. We're not exactly sure what's going on because we don't have great data, unfortunately. And even though you know, insects in particular make up most of the animal species on the planet. It's important that we really get a handle on how these interactions among species at the lower trophic levels are happening. And so we have to make the models a little bit more complex as a result of that. The other thing is to look at extinction per se and not just biodiversity loss. So that's taking into account the geographical distribution of species within these models and to try to anticipate the total loss of individuals from the species. In other words, extinction, as opposed to just a geographically specific loss of biodiversity. The final step, well, not final step, but certainly the third priority from our perspective is to do the same sort of modeling in the oceans, because we've only looked at the land surface here, and we'd like to incorporate the same methodology to look at extinctions in the seas. Slightly different system, both in terms of, you know, for example, dispersal is very different, but it has a lot of influences of oceanography that are a little bit more uncertain than our global circulation models. So it's going to be a challenge, but we need to get more data and more models, basically, to be able to get a real sort of robust picture of what's happening.
You just made me think, well, extinction isn't everything. You kind of reminded me of COVID, where, yes, there's the death rate, but there's also all the people with long COVID. That's another kind of damage. So in the ecology, we may not lose all the wheat when a new rust arrives, a new disease, but we may not have enough to feed ourselves. So there's that damage stage as well as extinction that we need to be concerned about.
Exactly, yes. And this comes back to the idea of resilience. Just because a community still persists from, for example, climate change, it's vastly weakened because the number of linkages in there, the number of nodes in that system have also dwindled. So coming back to that scaffold analogy, it's weak, and therefore when another disturbance comes along, and you can think of disturbances in terms of things like bushfires, you know, the people are burning down as we speak around the planet in different parts of the world. We have floods. We've just had massive floods in Australia. We have cold snaps, which is something that people, the deniers will use to say that, you know, climate change isn't happening, but that's actually a prediction of many of the climate models, where the extremes are getting more extreme. So when these intense weather and climate events happen, they just give more opportunity for massive collapse within systems that are already weakened through these processes, these ongoing processes. So yes, if you have long COVID, you're probably more susceptible to other diseases, your immune system is compromised, and you might even die from secondary complications, for example, high blood pressure or some sort of pulmonary condition. So yes, we have to look at all the elements that perturb these systems and drive them towards a lower state of resistance.
Well, we've got to wrap this up. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
I think one thing that I try to do, I mean, my job, I'm a little bit like what we say in Australia, I'm a little bit like an ambulance driver, in that, you know, every day I come into work and it's doom and gloom and the messages are not very nice. And it's some people ask me, you know, why would I bother doing what I'm doing, knowing how awful things are? Well, the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is thinking that, well, yes, the future is likely to be ghastly, but our decision on what we do today is going to dictate how ghastly that's going to be. So it's not a question of preventing future problems. It's damage control or mitigation. So if anything that I do can minimize that damage, accepting that damage is inevitable, that justifies what I do. And I think instead of giving up, people should have hope that they can contribute to minimizing that damage.
Less worse is better. That is where we are. The new paper is titled, Coextinctions Dominate Future Vertebrate Losses from Climate and Land Use Change. It's published December 16, 2022. From Adelaide, our guest is co-author Professor Corey Bradshaw from the Flinders University in Adelaide. To find out more and find links to the paper and all sorts of other things, check out my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, thank you for helping us understand the way all this life works together.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciated the discussion.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Next, Exposing Apocalyptic Economics with Steve Keen, as posted January 30, 2023 by TheAnalysis.News.
You may have noticed that while natural scientists are focused on the ecological costs of climate change, social scientists and politicians seem much less concerned with the economic costs. According to renowned Australian economist Steve Keen, the reason is terrifying. Dr. Keen has been going through the works of the most mainstream neoclassical economists on whom our politicians base their projections and looking at how they're arriving at their numbers regarding climate change. He has found that they repeatedly confuse climate, the foundation of our energy and food, with the weather, with some of the biggest names even stating that 87% of the economy won't really be affected by climate change because the jobs are primarily indoors. This is such a fundamental and apocalyptic mistake that it leaves little room for reform. Dr. Keen argues that we must simply abandon these economists and their framework, saying it's us or them. Steve Keen has a history of calling out junk economics. He correctly and famously predicted the 2008 recession and spent the years leading up to the subprime mortgage crisis berating mainstream economists for failing to account for the role of private debt and credit. If he says we need to sound the alarm, we should probably pay attention. Steve Keen, welcome to The Analysis.
Thank you. That's a very good introduction. Very thorough.
I want to make sure that I'm framing your position correctly, because you're familiar with the pernicious influence of big money on politics and economics, but you're saying the problem runs much deeper than just corruption, and that's why we can't swap out the good neoclassical economists for the bad ones.
It is simply what they believe. People think that people who are critical of economics from the outside of the profession often think that economists are shrills for the capitalists, that sort of thing. I've seen that quite regularly on Twitter, of course. And that's getting the horse before the cart, because, in fact, training in neoclassical economics, if you accept it, if you believe it, ends up making you effectively a zealot for your vision of what capitalism is. And you will then, you really have a belief in capitalism as the ideal social system. And therefore, if you see anything which challenges the sustainability of capitalism, there's an automatic tendency to reject it. And of course, that can benefit the capitalist class, but it's not why they do it. And this is what's happened in this particular case. No one paid William Nordhaus to assume that 87% of the economy would be unaffected by climate change, because it happens in carefully controlled environments. That's his own attitude to capitalism, that it's just, you know, given their model of how capitalism functions, it's an infinitely flexible system, therefore it can cope with anything, therefore climate change can't be a problem. And that mindset is what has determined their the predictions they've made, which are so badly based that they should simply be thrown in the garbage bin. And that's, of course, what I'm trying to explain to policymakers and media and so on.
So let's take a look at what they mean by climate within these models and what, say, a natural scientist would call climate. Let's make sure we're not making the same mistake that they're making.
Well, to some extent, I think we can blame how climate is defined in conventional organizations, like, for example, NOAA, the National Office of Oceanic Administration, I think it stands for, a wonderful acronym. I may have got the actual title there wrong. And they say that, you know, weather is what you experience on a day-by-day basis. Climate is the average of weather over a long period of time. And that really makes it seem, you know, that climate and weather are statistically different distributions, but the same basic data set. So, you know, weather's a particular day and climate's over a range of days. And that's fundamentally misleading when it comes down to what climate change actually means. To me, I think about climate as the actual structure of the fluid flows in the oceans and the atmosphere of planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And to me, climate change, for example, would mean going from the three circulation cells that currently set the weather patterns in each of the two hemispheres of the planet, North and South Hemisphere. So you have a cell where there's rising air at 0 degrees and falling at 30. That's the Hadley cell. Then you have what's called the Ferrer cell, which has falling and rising at 30 and 60, and then the polar is 60 to 90. And that's why you have such substantial temperature differences between the tropics, the temperate zone, and the polar zone, and relatively consistent temperatures inside each of those zones. Now, if that flips over, and it has flipped over frequently in the Earth's past due to natural factors, of course, if that flips over to a single cell, then what you'll have is rising air at the poles and at the equator, and falling air at the poles, and in the middle, effectively, generally speaking, a drought, a desert. Now that's climate change, and so that is a structural change to the patterns of fluid flows in both the oceans and the air that generate the weather we feel on a daily basis. And there's no way that it is not an average anymore. It's a complete change of the system that generates the weather. That's what climate change is.
Can you go through the disparity between the kind of description you've just given, the kind of description we might expect from a natural scientist, and the projections that these neoclassical economists are making?
Well, the description that the scientists are giving is existential.
Right.
If we exceed, and even they're saying they're giving vague numbers because, of course, this has never been done before, not only in the history of humanity, but also in the history of the planet. We've never had as rapid a change in the carbon dioxide levels as we're forcing on the planet right now. And of course, there are various structures which have evolved over time in our current climate, the Holocene climate, such as the Arctic having summer sea ice. So the Arctic reflects 90% of the energy that falls on it during summer. The Greenland, similar reflector of energy. Antarctica, the same in the southern hemisphere. The circulation patterns of the great ocean thermohaline circulation, which is an oceanic river, hundreds of times the volume of all the rivers, the continental rivers on the planet. So all those huge structural elements, that's the defining nature of the climate. And what they're saying, what scientists are saying, is that if we increase the temperature by as little as 1 degree, we could trigger a breakdown in each of many of those characteristics of the current climate. And that would then cause a cascade. The scientists have been saying numbers like don't let it increase more than 2 or 3 degrees. The most recent paper by Kemp and co, I think in 2021 or 2022, came out saying 3 degrees is their limit for absolutely unsustainable temperature increase. But you see figures as low as 1%. We've already exceeded 1%. So the scientists are speculating, but they're all the speculations say anything above that level, you're talking about such a change in the climate that we could no longer sustain the sedentary human civilization we've had for the last 12,000 years. Our agricultural system could be destroyed, and therefore the carrying capacity of the planet could fall from the area of 8 billion as we currently have down to 1 billion if we're lucky. Now that means 7 billion people die.
Wow.
So that's the scale that the scientists are talking about. Economists, on the other hand, are saying, and this is quoting Nordhaus, a 6-degree increase in temperature will cause an 8.9% fall in GDP compared to what it would be in the complete absence of climate change. If you look at the most recent IPCC report, Working Group 2, Chapter 16, is the economics chapter inside there. And that chapter said that a 4-degree increase in temperature by 2100, 4 degrees Celsius, could cause between a 10 and 23% fall in GDP compared to what it would be in the absence of climate change. And that therefore means they're assuming growth for the next 80 years, which would increase per capita incomes by a factor of 5. And they're saying rather than being 5 times as large, they'll be 4 times as large, which is trivial.
Wow.
So that's the difference. One is saying a minor decline in overall productive capacity while it still grows over time, where the scientists are saying we won't have a civilization past 4 degrees. Most scientists, and if you suggest 4 degrees level of warming, they're saying forget it. It's human civilization is over,
right,
at that level.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's a disparity, all right.
Huge.
It's enormous, and I think for those who do not know who Nordhaus is and who some of these figures are, this is not a case of, say, big tobacco finding some fringe person somewhere who will accept a bribe to say something crazy. These are the most mainstream figures.
Yeah, so Nordhaus, first of all, he has taken over the mantle of publishing one of the dominant textbooks, Paul Samuelson textbook. He is now the continuing editor of the Samuelson textbook on economics. He was elected president of the Economic Association at some time in the last few years. I've forgotten when that actually was. And he got the Nobel Prize, so-called Nobel Prize for economics in 2018. So he's high status in the profession. And he and a group of economists. It's only a very small band of economists, by the way. And this is one thing I try to emphasize to the profession. I say, for God's sake, ditch Nordhaus, because if you don't ditch Nordhaus, you'll be responsible for when the shit hits the fan, and the shit is coming, you will be, economics in general, will be responsible for letting this garbage, and frankly, that's the only way I can describe it, this garbage get published. Because if you had decent refereeing of papers on the basis of the science of climate change being applied to these economic papers, none of them would have been published.
I want to delve a little further into some of the examples that you talk about as you go through the papers that these people have published, the statements that they've made. The 87% number that's given, one of them about the Gulf Stream, which is absolutely terrifying. Can you go through some of the kind of extreme falsities that are being published on a very wide scale right now?
They have about four methods they've used to make up, and I emphasize make up numbers, okay? Not generate data, but make up numbers that then they say are related to climate change. So the very first was what they call the enumerative method. And the enumerative method, the way they describe it is that they take data from science papers and add up the damages that science papers say, and then you're adding up from the bottom up. So that's what they call the enumerative method. Now, when you take a look at Nordhaus 1991, To Slow or Not to Slow, The Economics of the Climate Change, published in the Economic Journal, which is published by Oxford University, certainly one of the top three or top five journals in economics in 1991. And then he said that there are some activities, such as microprocessor fabrication or open heart surgery, which occur in carefully controlled environments, that's literally a quote, which will not be particularly subject to climate change. On the other hand, there are other activities which are exposed to the weather and therefore exposed to climate change. He said, our estimate is that 87% of the American economy will be negligibly affected by climate change because it takes place in carefully controlled environments. Now that was, when you look at the table here, which is table 15 in that particular paper, I think, it was all of manufacturing, all of wholesale and retail services, all of the finance sector, most of real estate, except for a small amount of coastal real estate, and he even included mining, apparently not being aware that a lot of mining is open cut and therefore exposed to the weather. So that is the scale of it. And you would hope that it would just be an aberration. That got through, but later papers fixed it up. Instead, that was being maintained all the way through. And they don't use that method anymore, but that's one of the, they haven't rejected the numbers they got out of that. Now, when Nordhaus did his calculations, he had 3% of the economy being seriously exposed, which is largely agriculture and forestry, 10% marginally exposed. When he added up his numbers, he got a total of a 0.26% change in reduction in GDP for a 3-degree increase in temperature.
Wow.
Now, the reason he got that, because he, when it came to the section we said would be exposed, which is agriculture and forestry, he said he took into account the fertilizer effect of carbon dioxide. So he had somewhere between a plus 9.7 and a minus 10.5. And therefore, the average of the two is what he put in as the major source of damages. And that's where the 0.26% of GDP fall came from. And then he said, there may be other factors that aren't included here. I might bump it up to 1%. But my hunch, and literally the word hunch, in a so-called scientific paper, my hunch is that the damages will be no more than 2% of GDP from 3 degrees of warming. So that's one of their...
Wow.
Yeah, okay. And so that's a lot of those enumerative method ones come out with damages between positive, actually some of them think their fertilizer effects really good, you know, positive effects of up to 1%, and Richard Toll published one of those papers, down to about 2 or 3% fall in GDP. That's the range that they get.
Wow.
Second method they call the statistical method, and this is the very first paper that I actually saw, and I realized just how deluded they were on climate change. This is by Richard Toll in 2009, called The Economics of Climate Change, and in that paper he described what he called the statistical approach, which is used by Mendelsohn, who's one of the research colleagues of Nordhaus. He said Mendelsohn assumes that the variation of GDP with climate over space will hold over time. Now, what that means is Mendelsohn, in this particular case, the first, and initially just with America, they then generalized to a global distribution of income. And looking at, say, gross state products and average state temperature, you can then get this when you, and I've done this myself as it's just a simple exercise to show how stupid this is. If you take a look at the average temperature for every state in mainland America, continental America, and the average gross state product per capita, which is the state version of GDP, then you get a scatter plot. If you then graph the temperature on the horizontal and the income on the vertical, you get a scatter plot, which is a huge wide scatter plot. But if you do a quadratic regression on that, and they almost always use quadratics, what they call their damage functions, that quadratic will tell you that each degree increase in temperature reduces your GDP by about 0.3% times the temperature change squared. Now, that therefore means that a 10-degree increase in temperature will cause about a 15% fall in GDP. Ironically, that's a bigger number than Nordhaus himself uses. So his damage function is that the damage to GDP from temperature increase will be 0.227% times the temperature change. And that's where you get this, you know, 6-degree increase in temperature, about an 8% fall in GDP. But it's literally using the geographic nature of climate. So obviously the climate of Florida is different to the climate of North Dakota. Okay, but that's sitting inside exactly the same temperature distribution for global temperature. There's no change in global temperature between Dakota and Florida because they're on the same globe. And they simply assume that that very light variation, relatively trivial role of temperature in determining GDP, will be what climate change does over time. And the craziness of this is that if you, and I've made this case for a research paper, a project I'm working on right now, the reason that you can have a successful economy in Florida and have a successful one in Dakota is they trade with each other. The stuff that North Dakota can't produce that Florida can, the stuff that Florida produces that North Dakota can't, part of the income is because North Dakota is selling products to Florida. Right. Now, you can't sell through time, okay? You can't sell wheat produced in 2020 to people in 2100. Right. So the whole idea that you can use what happens over space as an anagram, what happens over time, is just nonsense. And again, it's showing they simply don't understand what climate change actually means. Now, the third method has come along after that, and that is that acknowledging that mistake, some economists have said, well, we need to have data where there's change in temperature, change in global average temperature, and we then compare that to either GDP or change in GDP. And that's been done by a number of people. So there's a paper by Kahn and Mahadis and a few others coming out of the International Monetary Fund. And they have said, well, there's a nonlinear relationship at the global, at the geographic level between temperature and GDP. So they've worked out what that nonlinear relationship is for change in temperature over the period 1960 to 2014. I think that's the data set they use. And they then extrapolated that forward 80 years. Now, that only works if there's no structural change to the climate over the next 80 years, which is nonsense, because they're talking about that they said that it's a 1/25th of degree Celsius change in temperature per year, which mounts up to 3.2 degrees over the next 80 years, will cause about, a 0.05 decline in GDP for each year. And therefore, they're saying that there will be a seven, and I love the false precision they give. These are supposed to be statisticians. If you, this sort of false precision shows you're a child, you don't know really what you're doing. They've said that there'll be a 7.22% fall in GDP by 2100 from a 3.2 degree increase in Celsius in temperature. Now, they can't even get today's GDP accurate to 0.1%. And here they're trying to predict GDP in 80 years' time to two decimal places of accuracy. It's just nonsense. Right. So that's the sort of thing there. But there's basically three methods. There's, what they're doing is really saying you can find the footprint for global warming in current data. And that's just nonsense. Okay, because, you know, it's a cascading effect, and it's the runaway process that we are now very, very close to triggering that is the really scary thing. The complete structural breakdown of our climate will occur over the next 80 years. And all these predictions are just nonsense.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Exposing Apocalyptic Economics with Steve Keen, as posted January 2023 by TheAnalysis.News. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at EcoShock.org.
I'm not a particularly religious person myself, but there's a church in my community that's a good actor. And so for several years, I volunteered on its committee as a community. And they were getting hit with thousands of dollars of new insurance costs because increased risk of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, this, the climate instability we're seeing right now, the crazy cold temperatures in America, crazy hot temperatures in Europe, drought in California, now it's flooding California. That volatility is being generated by the extra energy that we've trapped in the atmosphere courtesy of carbon dioxide. So we're already seeing the real world couldn't give a damn about what economists think. Real world will do what the real world climate does under the energy pressure that we're putting on the biosphere. And that is going to make a laughing stock of the predictions of the economists probably in this decade. But it's at some point it'll be bleedingly obvious that their damage estimates have got absolutely nothing to do with what's actually going on, and the damages are far, far, far higher. And in that situation, anybody who's trusted economists either directly or indirectly by accepting their damage assessments and then putting that to insurance contracts and so on, they're going to be forced to pay out an absolute fortune, and they'll be bankrupted by the cost of climate change damages.
If we want to be able to think about this critically and productively and not make the same mistake as them, what is a good starting point for us to think about what is the role of climate in the economy?
First of all, just to handle what sort of changes are being spoken about, what is feasible to happen if the temperature rises any further. And I'll give one of my favorite examples, because it's terrifying, and the person who's making it is impeccable credentials. So the professor of chemistry at Harvard University, J.G. Anderson, was the person who discovered the hole in the ozone layer in the last century and led the campaign to close the hole. So his argument in a paper published in 2017 is that with the decline in the Arctic summer sea ice, that will trigger a breakdown of those three circulation cells. And that will mean that storms which currently develop over the plains of America, the central plains of America, which are enormous storms, will penetrate the stratosphere. So at the moment, those storms are restricted to the troposphere, which is below 20 kilometers where we live and work. If it gets into the stratosphere, it will take moisture into the stratosphere. And the current of the stratosphere is very, very low levels of H2O, so it's a very dry stratosphere. When that water passes in, it will also carry in chlorine and bromide, partially from our own industrial processes, but also even from volcanoes. And that chlorine and bromide will increase, according to Anderson's paper, increase the rate of destruction of ozone by a factor of 100. Hmm. And what that would mean is it's no longer safe to go outdoors for humans, particularly. Other animals with fur, slightly better chances than us. Plants, apparently, have got a fair bit of protection against high levels of UV, but we won't be able to go outdoors. And I'm sorry, that's the end of human civilization. If we can't, you can't go outdoors during daylight hours, then what happens to our civilization? It breaks down. So, and of course, people will die of skin cancer. So it's an appalling potential. Now, in that situation, if that's what starts happening, you haven't got an economy. And so that the existential stuff that I want people to realize is what we're playing with here. Mm-hmm. So that's the real danger. It's not a case of a bit of damage here, a few more percent insurance claims, stuff like that. It's you can no longer manage a human civilization, and you couldn't even manage hunting and gathering in that situation because you couldn't afford to hunt during the day. So it's existential. That's what I prefer to people to look at, rather than we're working in terms of percentages of GDP and damages and so on. That's the game the economists have played. And it's also a game of correlation, not causation. They have no theory as to how temperature causes GDP. They simply say, here's this correlation we've found in current data, and that's what we're going to use to predict the damages of climate change. It's completely irrelevant to what climate change will actually do to human civilization.
I'm going to ask you a tough question. Maybe it's too much for this interview. But my generation has never experienced a real recovery from 2008. COVID has caused more economic distress. We have major companies like Goldman Sachs is already laying people off in anticipation of another downturn. And we're having a conversation about how economists have wildly overestimated how good things are going to be. So is that we throw out these neoclassical economists who are making these terrible projections, if we put them aside and start to put a different theory in place, is there some feasible glimmer of sunlight that we can put in front of people to rally behind?
Well, the main thing is we have to drastically reduce the load we put on the planet in terms of the biosphere. So the carbon dioxide is the most obvious damage we're doing, but everything else we do as well. We're dumping plastics, which are damaging food chains throughout the world. Mm-hmm. We're intruding on what used to be virgin territory. So we're hitting up against, that's where the pandemic came from, the fact that we're intruding into areas which used to be, you know, no off limits for humans. Now we're the best possible host for any pandemic. Why attack any other animal when humans are so prolific and distribute the diseases so well? So we're making ourselves a target for all these, you know, elements of the hostile elements of the environment in which we live. So there's the only glimmer would be to say, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have to go into a catastrophe before we reverse direction. But what we have to say is we have to drastically reduce our load on the planet now, and that means a drastic fall in the consumption levels of the rich. And that can be both global rich, but also rich within each nation state. So it's not the poor who have to consume less, because even in the case of America, something like about 30% of people are living on the breadline, so you can't force them to consume less, but you have to make the rich consume less, and you have to radically and rapidly decarbonize the economy, and then you've also got to reduce our load on the planet so that we reserve at least half the planet for non-human life. And at the moment, we're using 97% of the planet. You know, the only parts we're not using, the ones that are simply impossible to use, such as Greenland and Antarctica and the tundra regions. But everything else we're exploiting to the hilt. And we have to say that no longer can be allowed. Now, I simply don't believe we're going to do it in time. Even if people in policy listen to me, which they won't do, they know how hard it would be to sell the sort of message I've got to the public. And if they try to sell that message before it becomes obvious as necessary, they'll lose their positions. So we won't do anything until we get absolutely obvious catastrophes that have to be blamed on climate change. Nothing else can be considered. And for example, something like the breakdown of the ozone layer of the Northern Hemisphere, that would be a wake-up call. Now, in that situation, what you have to be, if you're going to have any chance of maintaining human civilization through this process, you have to have measures in place that give you a chance to react to whatever catastrophe will come along. So if the catastrophe happens to be a collapse in wheat production, and that's quite a feasible one from climate change, then you have to have reserves of grain already stored in case there's a collapse in the crops, and you have to have a rationing system. So if everybody gets the same ration, you don't have people starving to death because they can't afford to buy the grain. You've got to go from a monetary capitalist economy to a ration-based, war-based economy, effectively. But all these things are so gigantic that you have to be prepared to throw a level of our energy, our activity at the planet that will dwarf what we did during World War II. These are going to happen. Okay? The question is, are they going to be enforced upon us, or are we going to try to manage it?
That's not an optimistic note to end on, but perhaps it's the kind of bluntness that we need to deal with a real world with a real climate and not the imagined world of these neoclassical economists. Steve Keen, this has been a very insightful interview. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Colin.
My thanks for permission to broadcast this discussion with Australian economist Steve Keen. The host is Colin Bruce Anthes. Check out theanalysis.news for more rowdy views. Find links and more comments in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That is all the time we have this week. I'm Alex Smith. Keep thinking, keep trying, and thank you for caring about this world, all of it.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges interviews Matt Taibbi on Hamilton 68. Hamilton 68 was a Twitter-based dashboard designed to be used by reporters and academics to, quote, measure Russian disinformation. Chris Hedges wrote, "The panic over Russian disinformation that followed the election of Donald Trump often relied on a source now known to have been fraudulent." Hamilton 68. Here's Hedges' February 10, 2023 interview of Matt Taibbi on the Real News Network. Taibbi is one of the reporters who was given access to the Twitter archives by the new owner, Elon Musk. Matt Taibbi is an author, journalist, and podcaster, and former contributing editor for Rolling Stone. He's publisher of the newsletter Racket on Substack. Chris Hedges is a journalist, Presbyterian minister, author, and commentator. He worked as war correspondent and reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005. Chris Hedges summarizes what Taibbi found.
Matt Taibbi has published an investigation, which you can read on his Substack, about a vast propaganda campaign called Hamilton 68, launched a year after Donald Trump won the presidency. It smeared critics of the Democratic Party from the left and the right as Russian assets. Hamilton 68 claimed it used a complex data analysis and relied on so-called disinformation experts to ferret out fake news on social media that emanated from the Kremlin. Hamilton 68, a computerized dashboard designed to be used by reporters and academics to quote-unquote measure Russian disinformation, run by Democratic operatives, including John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, and figures from the intelligence agencies such as the CIA, the FBI, and Homeland Security, as well as neoconservatives and establishment Republicans such as Bill Kristol, who do not support Trump and have been warmly embraced by the Democratic Party. Mainstream news outlets, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, PBS, NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, as well as Mother Jones, which ran 14 stories based on the group's alleged research, cited Hamilton 68 as an authoritative source, even as the site refused to disclose the data or methods it used to make its assessments. Hundreds, if not thousands, of media headlines were flagged as Russian bot infiltrations in online discussions about Brett Kavanaugh, Tulsi Gabbard's campaign, the Parkland shooting, U.S. missile strikes in Syria, and Bernie Sanders' campaign, many other stories. Fact-checking sites such as PolitiFact and Snopes also relied on Hamilton 68. Taibbi, given access to Twitter's internal memos and emails by Elon Musk, who bought Twitter, was able to expose not only fraudulent claims of Hamilton 68, but the massive failure of the press, which was a full partner in one of the worst forms of censorship since the red baiting of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, one that targeted people with dissident or unconventional opinions and accused them, in essence, of un-American activities. So let's go back, just set the stage right after the defeat of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party's response, just to remind viewers of the loss and how that response led to the rise of so-called disinformation experts and groups like Hamilton 68.
It's a complicated story. I think the backdrop to the Hamilton 68 story is, if you really want to look at the full timeline, the Columbia Journalism Review has a whole 26,000 word piece this week. The shortcut version of this story is that after Trump won the election, there was immediately a series of stories coming from different directions saying that the election was illegitimate, that Trump had been assisted by Russians, that there was some kind of collusion going on, and that there was disinformation in the news media that had been amplified by Russian accounts, that Trump's own accounts and hashtags and tweets had been amplified by Russians. Formally, August of 2017, this group Hamilton 68 came out. It's an outgrowth of both the German Marshall Fund and a think tank called the Alliance for Securing Democracy. And it was basically a tool designed to be used by reporters and academics that quote unquote tracked Russian disinformation by monitoring accounts that were called linked to Russian influence activities online. Now, they never disclosed what was on this list or what they were actually tracking. And it was only by accident, looking through some Twitter files, emails, that we find this big conversation where internally Twitter is saying, we've got the list, we've reverse engineered it, and they're not Russians. These are mostly ordinary people. Out of 644 accounts, only 36 of them began in Russia. And most of the rest, from what I found, were ordinary people, a lot of them right-leaning, but some of them on the left, too. So it was a fraud. It was a big, gigantic media fraud, basically equal parts disinformation on the part of this think tank, but also, as you alluded to, the enormous media failure, which would be, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Of those 36, weren't a lot of them from your story, RT was Russia Today, was the Russian television station.
There were several RT-related accounts. There were some Sputnik accounts. There were some Russian embassy accounts, Sphere of Foreign Affairs, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of these were sort of official Russian accounts. Now, Hamilton eventually transitioned to a more open system that was only tracking Russian official accounts, which is interesting in itself. That's actually more of a real service. But what they did is they piled all these real accounts that had real opinions that maybe a channel like RT or the Russian foreign ministry, they might have an interest that coincided, but these were real people in America and Canada and Great Britain who had these opinions. They either favored Trump or were retweeting hashtags like walk away or fire McMaster. And this group just described that as part of a sort of Russian influence campaign when in fact it was not that.
Just give us, before we go in, you actually reached out to these people, some of these people, I'll let you explain that. But just give us a sense of the scale, because it was massive. It just dominated the press. I mean, we were talking before we went on the air. I think one of the reasons the media organizations are going to ignore it is because what are they going to say? We're sorry for the last 4 years. It's such an egregious failure to admit what they did. It ends up looking like an article from The Onion.
Yeah, this would be a difficult thing to retract in a way. I wanted to hear what the innocent explanation was, not only from this group, but from all the media companies that ran these stories. So I not only sent queries up, but I kind of threw a fit about it publicly on Twitter and online, you know, sort of daring them or taunting them in an effort to try to get comment out. There was some reason that I wasn't privy to. I really wanted to hear it. And they no commented me until the story made a big splash on the internet, at which point some of them started to come in. Now, the media people haven't commented yet, but there's no excuse for what happened with them because, you know, you and I both been reporters, Chris. If someone comes to me with a story and says we're tracking Russian influence, we have a magic box that tracks Russian influence, and they are connected to all these organic political activities. You think about things like hashtag walk away, that's Democrats who are leaving the party. Hashtag fire McMaster, that's Republicans who are against H.R. McMaster, right? Hashtag release the memo, it's Republicans who want Devin Nunes' memo out. All these things were quote unquote linked to Russian influence on all the biggest channels and newspapers in America, and that the source was wrong. I mean, again, what would you do as a reporter? Because I'd say, what's in the box, right? Tell me how it works. And they never asked that question.
Well, I love this. This is from your article. It's Laura Rosenberg, the two founders of Hamilton 68, the blue and red team of former counselor to Marco Rubio, Jamie Fly, and Hillary for America foreign policy advisor Laura Rosenberger, told Politico they couldn't reveal the names of the accounts because the Russians will simply shut them down. It's kind of like Joe McCarthy's empty briefcase.
Yeah, that's what they were doing. They were saying inside this thing, there are subversives who are linked to Russia, but they weren't that. Like I looked in the list. Chronology here is a little complicated. Twitter was upset about all this stuff. And so they figured out what was in the list, being in a unique position to do it because they had the data. So they recreate the list, and it's full of all these people. It's like Consortium Editor Joe Loria. There are all these small, low-influence Trump accounts with names like Classy Girl for DJ Key, Trump Dyke is another one. There's lots and lots of people. And I reached out to, you know, probably a couple of dozen of them, talked to a bunch of them on the phone. They're all over the world, but they're real people. They're not Russian agents. They just had these opinions. And so they were used as sort of fodder to create these fake news stories.
So why did the most prestigious and powerful media organizations, and why did universities such as Harvard, Princeton, MIT, why do you think they so enthusiastically signed on for the witch hunt?
Well, I think this is connected to a bigger picture that I don't fully have yet. I mean, I think there are things that are going to come into view, maybe not necessarily for me, but there are people working on it. And the idea is, I think that this whole concept of Russian disinformation was used as a battering ram to get inside of companies like Twitter and to influence them to open their doors to sort of government efforts to moderate the platforms, right? We don't like the fact that you're not letting us censor this or that. We want to have more direct control over things. You're housing Russian disinformation activities online. They all got dragged to the Senate floor and the House floor in late 2017. If you remember that, started with Senator Warner, Mark Warner of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, spread to all like the House committees, House Intelligence Committee, and there was Energy and Commerce. It never ended. The companies finally said uncle and let these people in. I think this is all related. These stories were used basically to make the argument that you have to let us start censoring people.
So, as you know, I was overseas for 20 years, and it just smells like these CIA front groups. So CIA, in some countries I was in, actually own newspapers. But do we know the genesis of it? Do we know how deep these roots go?
So that's a tough question to answer yet. I think we got to look at some of those things. You look at the advisory board of who's on the think tank that birthed this thing. It's chock full of former intelligence officials, Michael Morell, the ex-CIA director. He was going to be Hillary's CIA chief. Mike Chertoff, who was the Homeland Security chief during the Iraq period. There's a former deputy head of the NSA on there. And then Hamilton is also connected to a company called New Knowledge that was the advisor to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. A number of their people were involved in testifying before the Senate and the House.
Twitter was complicit because, as you point out, they did, through this reverse engineering, realize that this was a scam, but they did not make it public and continued to engage in the censorship that was demanded of them. Talk about that. And also, can you talk about Twitter's secret blacklist?
So the first question, yes, Joel Roth was the trust and safety chief at Twitter, who became kind of an infamous figure after the first batch of Twitter files was released because he was considered influential in suppressing the Hunter Biden story. But he actually pushed back against this. There's a number of quotes from him, and he's saying, I think we have to just call this out on the BS it is. That's one of the more explosive quotes from him. He's saying that this dashboard will take ordinary conservatives and accuse them of being Russian. But he was met with the opposition within the company, sort of senior former White House officials who worked in the comms department. We're saying we have to be careful on how we push back. There's a gentleman named Carlos Manier who went on to work for Pete Buttigieg, who says, I want to push back too, but we have to play the longer game. As you say, Twitter's role is difficult to assess because on the one hand, they didn't play ball with Hamilton 68, but they also didn't make it public either. So I don't know how you call that one. I mean, they are complicit in a way, for sure.
So let's talk about the press formula. I love it when you do these. You have a habit of kind of boiling it right down to the essence. You said, here's the formula for how it worked. Defamation became hardwired into the media landscape. Quote, research institute makes invented bot claims. Reporters toss said claims at hated targets, like Tulsi Gabbard. Headlines flow. You said the scam needs just three elements. credential of someone like former FBI agent Watts, the absence of any semblance of fact-checking, and the silence of companies like Twitter. But it was, it worked exactly as you pointed out, and with just no incredulity. I mean, they just swallowed it whole.
It's hard for me to grasp because I can understand a couple of reporters getting beat by this, but all of them? I mean, that's difficult to understand. And then there were obviously a few of us that I know you would never follow. Like you and I talked about that at the time, how ridiculous all these stories were. People like Glenn Greenwald specifically called out this site. I did as well a few times. There was actually, believe it or not, a Tucker Carlson segment about it. But I would say 99% of the working reporters kind of fell for this. And nobody within these institutions to whom this was pitched backed up on it, as far as I know. I haven't found that yet, but there aren't reporters coming out of the woodwork who said, oh, I got pitched by these folks and I didn't do that story, or I exposed them. Because there's only two ways that you can go. If somebody pitches you and you find out they're fake, you have an obligation at that point to kind of out it, don't you? I mean, yeah. I would think. So it's remarkable not only that it happened, but also now that we know what they did, that nobody's backing up.
Your fundamental job as a reporter is to determine whether it's fake or not. That's what being a reporter means. But there was zero effort.
Right. And that's what's so amazing. Again, you know, you think about what you did for a living, what I've done for so long. You think about what somebody like Jeff Gerst did for, you know, years before this Columbia Journalism Review piece that came out this week. Your phone call after phone call, right, to ascertain what happened. And during this period, you had these incredible pieces where somebody at a magazine like Mother Jones would say, here's what Russian bots are pushing today. And they would just look at the dashboard and then just start writing. There's no middle part to this where you make a phone call, right? So they basically automated the sourcing process for these folks, and it was phony. So I think it's a dangerous thing. And the problem with this is that, well, this was a pretty simple, cartoonish almost scam. There are lots of more sophisticated ones out there that will be harder to unravel.
I mean, David Korn at Mother Jones has dined out on this for 5 years. And I think you mentioned before, he's written some kind of a response to Jeff Gerst. What did he say?
The Columbia Journalism Review's 24,000 word piece is a big fail. And, you know, again, at first, I kind of sympathized. I knew David a little bit. And, you know, in this business, it happens. Like, sometimes sources lie to you and you screw up. Like, you fall for something. It does happen. It shouldn't, right? I mean, it's not like being a doctor where if you screw up, somebody dies necessarily. But sometimes mistakes happen and you get a source like Christopher Steele to you, and he's got all these credentialed people vouching for him, right? You can see how that can happen. But you got to own it when that happens. You can't turn around and attack people for describing how that was wrong. I was very upset by Mother Jones' response to this whole thing. These organizations need to reestablish their credibility. And Gerst, who worked, you know, at your paper, Bob Woodward now is saying that they have, you know, these companies need to look themselves in the mirror, and they won't do it. Curious to hear your thoughts about what.
I mean, I think it goes back to your book, Hate Inc. First, tell us what the response has been. I mean, it's been this deafening silence.
Nothing. Again, started out as a 26,000 word piece. If a book length investigation in the Columbia Journalism Review doesn't get you 30 seconds on CNN, then I don't know what will, you know, what would prompt a response at this point.
Well, but what about the data? I mean, you have printed the data and there's no response.
Well, it's worse than that. They've actively said the opposite. I mean, not that I mind, I'm used to it at this point, but there have been lots of stories about how what an awful person I am and what an awful person Elon Musk is.
I mean, it's irrelevant. I mean, nobody's ever accused Cy Hirsch of being warm and fuzzy. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just silly. I'm joking, of course. I like you very much. But it just has nothing to do with the topic.
Yeah, it's a total, you know, to use a journalism cliche, it's a non-denial denial,
right?
You're not addressing the issue. There was an amazing line in the Mother Jones piece about the CGR thing where they said, they're saying, is arguing that the collision didn't happen, but in a sense, it did happen, right? Which is, I don't know, that's exactly what we're trained to assess. Did it happen really or in a sense, right? Like, if it's just in a sense, we can't print it. Like, that's the entire purpose of a newspaper.
What you're watching is the complete moral bankruptcy in real time of the press, which, and I'll go to your book, Hate Inc., because I think you made an important point, where media organizations, unlike the old model, have now siloed themselves to cater to a particular demographic. And when you're catering to that demographic, what you're in essence doing is feeding that demographic what it wants to hear. And we had mentioned the other day when we spoke about the Caliphate podcast at the New York Times, which was based on one source that was completely fraudulent. And I had been in the Middle East 7 years. I remember listening to just the first 10 minutes, and it had this kind of snuff porn quality to it, people being crucified on crosses and stuff. And it would just stank of fiction, I mean, having come out of the Middle East. And there's no accountability. I mean, the reporter, it wasn't fired because they fed their demographic what they wanted to hear. And I think that has eroded accountability, because it all becomes about stroking the demographic as a commercial model. I'm just summing up, you know, the points you made in your book.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Once upon a time, right? I mean, not to be all back in the day about it, but if you printed something like Caliphate, if you did a story like that and put your whole weight into it, and it was completely fake, and you did no work to see whether it happened, it was a career-ending thing. It could be a career-ending. Right.
Yeah.
And that hung over every reporter's head. That was the defense mechanism of the business. That's gone. There is no sort of Damocles over your head now when you work. If you make a mistake, it's good, because this is an entertainment product now. It's not a service, and you're not trying to determine the truth. It's not like an evidentiary process. I don't know how to think about it, honestly.
Well, and if you report, as you have done, in such a way that discredits or critiques or undermines that narrative, then I think you and Glenn have become examples of this. You are very viciously attacked. I don't follow it closely, but I think they've now calling you some kind of closet right winger. I don't know what they're calling you, but that becomes a response.
Yeah, that's the go-to response now. The Washington Post amusingly actually described me as conservative journalist. One of their pieces, and before I even heard about it, there was such an uproar online that they sort of silent edited it out of the piece.
Isn't it the Washington Post that won the Pulitzer for the Russiagate material that they then took down off their website? Is that the same?
That's the same Washington Post that ran a sort of a house editorial this week talking about how objectivity is dead. And I was no fan of objectivity necessarily as a model, but as an aspiration, absolutely. That was what the business is all about. We're trying to just ascertain what's true or not. Like, that's kind of the basic function of what we do. And, you know, they're moving into something, some other world now. And it's very sad to watch.
Well, that's why they're crucifying Julian Assange. Democrats loved him with the Iraq-Afghan war logs. And then he had the honesty to print the Podesta emails. If you have them and don't make them public, you can do that as a choice. But you can't then call yourself a journalist. So I find the state, I mean, it's, and I've been in the business a long time, it's extremely depressing. I want to, before we close, bring up, so we saw the Biden administration attempt to appoint this woman, Nina Yanukovych, as the disinformation czar. Now, she's been at the forefront of Russian disinformation. She calls Julian Assange scum. So they tried to set this up in the Homeland Security. It was kind of too much, too unpalatable to establish at this moment a ministry of truth in the United States. Is that where we're headed?
I think that was the idea. Whether we're going to get there or not is an open question. I mean, I think some of the companies don't want to go along. That's the subtext, actually, of this whole, the whole Trump years, is that the government wanted increasing amounts of control over these platforms. Some of the platforms, sometimes for reasons, because they were greedy and they wanted to keep some certain foreign markets open, pushed back. And now there's been this increasingly this sort of intense cry for access by agencies like the DHS, which was what New Jackets was going to be. It was going to be under Homeland Security. Well, they did still go through with something like that. They just didn't create the open board. Lee Fong did a report in The Intercept outing how that works. We've seen sort of echoes of it in the Twitter files. We do see how requests for content moderation are routed through the FBI and DHS specifically. There's a bureaucracy that's been set up. They want, whether they're going to get it absolutely or how much they've gotten it is kind of an open question. As you see that some of the companies are breaking ranks openly, and that's what this argument's about.
Well, aren't they getting it through subterfuge, in essence?
Yeah, no, they're creating a panic around something. And look, yes, these things all do exist. Like, there are foreign information operations that do exist. Russia has one. They based it on ours, but they do have one. They do these things. They do create social media accounts. They do try to introduce themes into our conversations. And there are domestic extremists in America. You know, there are lunatics on all sides, but there are, of course, racists and crazies and people who make threats. It's a difficult question, though, how to deal with that. But they amplified these problems in order to get access. They said, these problems are emergencies. We must get in. You must let us have control. And they lied about the scale of it.
Well, the difference is this isn't against extremism. It is about protecting a neoliberal order, which has visited tremendous suffering on the American people that they have no intention of changing. In fact, they will accelerate it. And so it becomes, in essence, finding a scapegoat. I mean, the reason Trump wins the elections is not because the white working class has been impoverished and dethroned, but because of Russia. That was Matt Taibbi. You can read his article, which you should read, on his Substack on Hamilton 68. I want to thank the Real News Network. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
You heard the Chris Hedges interview of Matt Taibbi on Hamilton 68, recorded on February 10, 2023. Matt Taibbi is an author, journalist, and podcaster. He's publisher of the newsletter Racket on Substack. Chris Hedges is a journalist, Presbyterian minister, author, and commentator. He reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005. In April 2022, he began podcasting The Chris Hedges Report on TRNN, the Real News Network. Please look up the Zoom recording and transcript of this conversation on the Chris Hedges Report on TRNN. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.